I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, I think we've decanted for long enough. It's time to sit back and enjoy Two Sharp Reds with Mark Schwarzer and Ollie Giel.
Yes, thank you, Eddie. It certainly is. It is that time of the week where myself, Ollie Giel, and Australia's third favourite son, Mark Schwarzer, like to try a bottle of red wine, and we will aim to compare that bottle of red to a player, a footballer, past or present. Now, Mark, last week we forgot to talk about our wine from the start, so I've got something I really want to say, but I'm going to hold off just in case we forget to talk about the wine again. So I think I just think it's important to, you know, be structured.
Good decision.
Yeah, okay, let's get stuck into it. What red have you gone for this week?
I've gone for a McGuigan Estate red wine. It's a Merlot, Southeastern Australia, 2020. Outstandingly intense and rich wines from the premium vineyards of Southeastern Australia. That's what it says on the label anyway.
Oh, I'm happy with that. So Southeastern Australia, would that be considered, do you think, anywhere sort of between Victoria and South Australia, I think? That's sort of the territory. Well,
Southeastern, yes. It'd be Victoria, wouldn't it?
Yeah. There's another lesson for us then, learning how to pronounce the wine and then learning our geography.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I've gone for a New Zealand wine this week, a Marlborough Pinot Noir, a trustworthy, delightful red, perfectly ripe, with some very intense and exciting flavours. So we've done that. We've ticked that off. We've reminded, you know, we've been able to talk about the wine, so we've done well. Plenty we need to talk about, as always, and I think it's right that we start off with our second confirmed relegated side of the 2020-21 season. Of course, West Bromwich Albion. They joined Sheffield United and going down this season. They lost pretty convincingly in the end, 3-1 to Arsenal. Goals from Willian, Pepe, Emil Smith-Rowe with his first Premier League goal. And unfortunately for Sam Allardyce, Mark, that's his first relegation.
You were buzzing to actually talk through that report match mini match report there that Arsenal have actually scored three goals for a change.
Yeah, well, Willian's first goal for Arsenal.
Yeah, which is really it's a real shame. It's a real shame that it's taken him 35 games. Is that right?
Yeah,
35 games to get on the score sheet in the Premier League for Arsenal. Listen, he's a phenomenal. He was a phenomenal player and unbelievable guy. Top pro. It obviously just hasn't worked out. Certainly not his first season at Arsenal. I hope he's able to show Arsenal fans what he can do, because he is a top class player, and he's, like I said, he's a top guy as well. It's just a shame that it's kind of worked out the way it has. Is it a surprise that West Brom are relegated? No. Is it a surprise it's taken to the 35th game? Yeah, it is actually. I thought they'd be gone a while ago. Salim Allardyce. Listen, first time in his career, but seriously, you know, the odds are stacked massively against you when he first and foremost took the job. The only thing I'd say is, and this is the only negative I would say about Sam Allardyce's time at West Brom, is that it took him 10 games to win his first Premier League game. So whether that's to do, I think he was like 2 years out of the game as management. Does that have anything to do with it? I don't know. Did the players just not cotton on to what he really wanted? It took time to bring in players also in that January transfer window, which was always a difficult part of it. But it just goes to show you that if a team does make, a club makes a change mid-season, how important, particularly when the clubs are down at that bottom, actually even the same, I suppose, when teams are looking to try and progress forward. The two ends of the spectrum, great example. Chelsea and West Brom, they make changes at key moments in the season. Chelsea were in danger of falling away and missing out on certainly Champions League position and possibly faltering with the other tournaments throughout the course of the season, the remainder of the season. They make the change. Thomas Tuchel comes in. He's lost one Premier League game. You know, I mean, if you had a table, if the table had started from when Thomas Tuchel arrived at the club,
he would be second on the table behind Pep Guardiola and Manchester City by 4 points. So far better position than they are currently in terms of points distance from Man City. And it probably would be a real go for it, you know, a real fight on for the season. That's obviously not the case. But my point is how well he's adapted, how quickly he's found his stride. This is a guy that's never worked in the Premier League before. And one would argue and say, well, listen, he had an infinitely better squad, better players and everything else. Of course. But the previous manager did as well and didn't work out for him. Sam Allardyce, on the other hand, came in and took him 10 games to win his first game. And that's ultimately, in his time there, what cost him. It's not the reason, ultimately, why West Brom are going down, because the damage was done before that. Certainly, it was a big contributor to their position. And he was well aware that the chances were very much against him to stay in the league. But obviously believe that with the right willy and dilly in January transfer window, things may work out. And they almost did. You know, there was a bit of a revival there. But I just think, like I said, it was all a little bit too late.
So it's been a really frustrating season, I'm sure, for what really is one of the great yo-yo clubs of the Premier League in West Brom. Sacking Slaven Bilic, and I think, you know, looking at certainly the comments from a lot of the fans, they are frustrated because he's a well-liked character as well, which whether or not maybe that hadn't, you know, for those early sort of 10 games, that might have had an effect. But looking back on the season, did we see an improvement from the players under Allardyce, do you think, at the very least? Individually, or was there...
I think they had more of an identity. I think they had more of an identity, and there was... just seemed to be that little bit more fight and a little bit more difficult to beat. Whereas under Slaven Bilic, they were a little bit too easy. They were a little bit pushovers. They rolled over a few times. Lacked a little bit of fight. They had quality. I mean, you know, let's not forget, Bilic got the sack the very next day or 2 days after they had a great result away at Manchester City.
Yeah,
at the time, Manchester City were doing really well as well. So, you know, that was the surprise. But the problem is, obviously, the damage had been done prior to that. He hadn't, the way they were playing, I think the lack of a little bit of fight, there was serious question marks raised. And I think very clear to certainly the hierarchy at West Brom, they believed that he wasn't the man that was going to keep them up. Obviously, it's always a risk when you make those changes. But I'll go back to it. It's often you see a bounce back when a new manager comes in. Just West Brom didn't have it until 10 games in. And that's a killer for them.
They seem to make the decision at the right time, though. Because remember when we talked about Sheffield United, and it just felt really weird when they got rid of Chris Wilder, because it felt like, well, season's done. Well, you know, that
yeah, but off. I think the Chris Wilder thing wasn't about where Sheffield United were now. Or were in the table. It wasn't about they were going to get relegated, pretty much certainly. You know, it was more of a disagreement on how to take the club further forward once they're in the Championship. And I think part of the problem was Chris Wilder was when he made decisions on transfer dealings, for example, in the summer, those key decisions didn't go his way. The players he brought in didn't work for him. And for Sheffield United, it was a lot of money invested in a couple of players. You know, Rian Brewster was one of them. And listen, we don't know the ins and outs, whether or not it was Chris Wilder who solely had a decision to make on that, or whether it was other people involved, or someone else made the decision and Chris Wilder had nothing to do with it. That could also have been the case. But there was clearly a disagreement in that regard on how they go forward, moving forward. Who has a say in recruitment, direction of the club? And my understanding, and what was been reported a lot, was that Chris Wilder wanted more control and he wasn't going to get it. So in the end, he walked, or they came to an agreement that they were going to part ways.
So then we're looking at managers and leaving. Sam Allardyce signed an 18-month contract, and there's a clause to suggest that both either the club or himself can pull the trigger at any point now. Will he stay, do you think?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because it makes you wonder in the first place. I suppose that clause is to do with, kept him up. He would have been given the job permanently for another season. Obviously, he had the job permanently for another season. And that would have been, on top of his bonuses, the added reward, of course. Sure. And then it gives both parties, like you said, an opportunity now to walk away. And the question is, I suppose Sam Allardyce needs to ask himself, is it 66 years old? Does he want to be in the championship and play 46 games? You know, has he got the energy and enthusiasm to do that? I would say yes, unless there's another opportunity to go back and, you know, to stay in the Premier League. That's the only reason for me that, why he wouldn't do it. Because the reason I say he has enthusiasm, he must have, because why did he come back in the first place? You know, 2 years out, 66 years old, what, just because you're playing 8 games fewer in the Premier League, does that mean, you know, that means that it's that any easier? Absolutely not. It's still probably equally as difficult. You know, the job of staying in the Premier League, being part of the Premier League in a 38-game season is probably equally as difficult as it is to be in the Championship and get promotion.
Okay, Mark, it's time that I want you to get your crystal ball out. And no, you didn't mishear me. Don't be rude. I now want to figure out the top four with you.
Okay.
Because it's pointy end of the season. We've roughly got about 3 games to go. Some teams have got 4. Currently, our top four, Man City, Man United, Chelsea, Leicester. Okay, now I'm going to extend this down to...
You don't need to.
I'll extend this down to...
You don't need to.
No, to Everton.
You don't need to. No, you don't need to.
Hang on. Just hear me out. Everton, because they've got 4 games, so they've got a game in hand for Tottenham. But essentially, knocking on the door, we have West Ham, 58 points. Liverpool 57 and Tottenham 56.
No chance.
You've poo-pooed that entire intro. So this is going to be a quick segment, is it? You reckon top four is what it is?
No, not at all. It's not done. I actually think that Liverpool are going to finish in top four. That's crucial. Okay, that's critical. The critical moment for Liverpool is Thursday against Manchester United. They win that Liverpool, they finish top four. They draw or lose it, then I think if they draw it, if they draw it, I still think they'll make top four. If they lose it, I don't think they will. Because, you know what? Even if they lose it, they may still do it. Because Leicester have United, Chelsea. They actually play Chelsea twice in a matter of 3 days apart from each other. FA Cup final, Premier League game. And then they've got Spurs last game of the season, Leicester.
It's a tough run-in, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a very, very tough run-in. And that was always the fear for Leicester, is if they don't have enough points. So they're on currently 63 points with 3 games to go. Liverpool have 4 games to go and on 57. So, you know, what are you talking about? 6 points difference. If Liverpool lose to Manchester United, it's 6 points difference. Okay, so I'm going to say Leicester will actually do it. If Liverpool lose, Leicester will do it.
Okay.
If I actually think Liverpool have to win. I think even if Liverpool draw, it won't be enough.
So then what about from a West Ham perspective? They're currently above Liverpool, but as you said, they've got 1 game fewer, 58 points. They seem to be running out of a bit of steam.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, I was at the game against Everton on the weekend and they just looked... They looked a little bit flat. They looked like a team that were feeling the pressure a little bit to finish in that Champions League position. You know, they had an opportunity to close the gap. I just think they felt the pressure a little bit. If you look at their remaining fixtures, at West Ham, how they've been performing all season, should pick up 9 points.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Brighton away. I mean, I know you can't just say that. And I know you can't write off Brighton. Brighton at home have turned the corner. They were great, you know, against Leeds last weekend. I know they lost midweek, but they're sending off. That changed the game. They got West Brom. Are West Brom going to be even more difficult to play against now that the pressure's off?
Yeah.
And often you see it. Often you see with teams, you know, they start to really come on their own when the pressure's off. And then they've got Southampton last game of the season. It's so difficult to pick, but I like I said, the ask me after Thursday when Man United play Liverpool.
From Liverpool down, we can forget about it. Tottenham, no chance.
Well, Liverpool. So fifth and sixth, my understanding, will be Europa League, and seventh will be Conference League, European Conference League.
Which sounds a bit funny to say Conference League, because obviously in this country, Conference League is quite low down.
Yeah, it's very true. The fear as well, before we move on from West Ham, from a lot of fans I've seen, desperate they don't want Europa League. You know, it's either bomb out or because Europa League...
No, I don't get that mentality. I don't get it.
But they're just the fear is they're not a big enough club to be able to...
Yeah, but I've done it before with two teams. You know, certainly your league position is affected 100%. Most times your league position is affected with the lesser teams. Middlesbrough, Fulham got to two European Cup finals, one with each, and our league form those two seasons was certainly affected. Mm-hmm. But we didn't get relegated. We actually made it quite comfortable in the end, and we got to a final. And it was, and if you ask those, you know, you ask those sets of fans, the vast majority of them who were around at that time, who remember those times, experienced, would say that it's some of the best moments in their whole time, in their whole life, supporting that club. So I don't understand the mentality. I really don't. I think West Ham should be grabbing hold of any opportunity to play in Europe. Doesn't matter. Everton fans, same. Even Spurs and Arsenal. Jeez, I mean, Arsenal. Gosh, you know, that they should be able to play any league at the moment.
Yeah. Any league.
Well, I mean, any European league. So if they play Conference League or whatever, they should just be happy to be able to get a chance to play back in Europe again because of the way they've been.
I totally agree with you. Mark, last week we did a round of applause for Chelsea women, and I think it's probably time to do it again.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Congratulations, and not because, of course, they have won the WSL, but of course, the most important thing to us here is that Sam Kerr finishes top goal scorer. She's now done that in three nations, for Perth, in the States as well, and then now in Europe, which is fantastic for her. You saw
Perth's nomination, by the way, just want to let you know. Perth
well,
is not
Perth
a nation.
Glory, yeah.
Because you said in three nations.
Right.
Perth is not a nation. I know they like to think they're a nation,
they're
but they're
pretty
not.
Far away.
Oh, they are far away, aren't they?
Most secluded, most isolated city in the world, Perth.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
That there, goes there with go. That and what's the capital of Iceland? Reykjavik is my two favourite, trivia.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah. Is that all you got?
No, just my favourites. It's just my quick draw, you know, Mexican standoff, you know, trivia. No, but she's done a fantastic job seeing her chat. Post game across Optus Sport was brilliant as well. She speaks so well and just so stoked for her, because we've talked about it before. But one brilliant thing that you've talked about is, you know, it took a little while for her to feel settled almost, and it can't have been easy just from a life perspective when she arrived. You know, so many of the Aussies, you know, quite a few of them at Arsenal as well, arrived at that similar point, and you're thinking, geez, that's not an easy time to move to England, you know, and hit the ground running. So
it's just been really unfortunate for him in a lot of ways that the current climate has happened at that time, you know, at the time that those older girls have arrived. So it's certainly made things more difficult. So arguably what she's accomplished so far is even more impressive that she has settled so well. And actually all the girls have settled really, really well here in
they're superstars,
England.
Mark. They're superstars.
Yeah, they've been brilliant. Absolutely. What I liked about Sam Kerr's interview is how raw it was and how natural it was. There was no staging of it. There was no almost like switching off and giving you the standard monosyllabic responses to interview questions. She was just more natural and very relaxed with it all. And if anything, there was almost a sense of a little bit of being uncomfortable talking to the camera.
Totally.
And I think that's kind of made him even more endearing. And yeah, listen, she's been phenomenal. She thoroughly deserves the success that's going her way. She's also, the way she spoke about her teammate, Fran Kirby, was exceptional, as well as the rest of her teammates, because she was very quick to then point out, listen, it's a whole team effort, and the way that the team has played has allowed her and Fran Kirby to be as successful they have. I mean, a lot of things fall into place, and it just, they seem to thrive off one another. And I think what was good as well was that the first time that Chelsea played Reading early on the season, they won 5-0 as well away from home, but Sam didn't score. I think she had a couple of assists in that game, whereas on the weekend she got on the score sheet. So heavily involved, got on the score sheet, made sure that she finished top goal scorer, which is great. And now, listen, they've got 1 week to prepare less than a week now to prepare for the biggest occasion, arguably now, for them, you know, to try and win that Women's Champions League trophy, which will be phenomenal if they do that.
So I just want to talk a little bit about Sam Kerr and the Matildas. But before we do that, just to wrap up the chat about the WSL in particular, of course, now the head coach or the head manager of Arsenal, Joe Montemurro, the Aussie, he comes back home. How do you see his kind of future looking, do you think? Because he's done a phenomenal job at the Gunners. Like he is, there's not a bad word spoken about some of the, you know, when I've heard people talking about him.
It was surprising. I was listening to Heather Garrick on the weekend talk about Joe and about him leaving Arsenal, and that she was surprised. She was surprised that he was leaving, and also kind of a little bit disappointed that he wasn't staying over here because he'd been doing so well, and it was great to see an Aussie coach doing so well. Had kind of done everything he needed to do in Australia, certainly domestically, and she hoped that he'd be picked up by the FFA or the FA.
Yeah.
To be, you know, in some way or another, be involved with the national team. And if not, she talked about him being involved in the development of the national team players or future Matildas, and that's key as well. And apparently, you know, that's one of his strengths. And certainly, you would think that you would hope. I don't even think. I don't think we can assume anything. I would just hope that the FFA. Were on the phone the minute it was had broken that Joe was leaving Arsenal coming back to Australia.
Perfect fit, really.
Absolutely. I mean, I know obviously they've appointed the new head coach for the Matildas, but listen, this guy needs to be involved somewhere along the line. And you never know what happens with the Matildas, you know, in terms of the current manager, how long is he in his place for? What happens if things don't go quite well? So to plan, and maybe they need to make a decision. If you've got someone in the background like Joe waiting, prepared, knows the stuff inside out. The girls know him. He's been highly successful in Europe. What a better... I mean, I know I'm jumping miles ahead and I'm not even giving the current manager a chance right now. But his first two games in charge weren't great. But listen, it's a pandemic and very difficult circumstances. But let's hope the Matildas get it all sorted out very, very quickly and have a wonderful World Cup.
Well, that's exactly right. And this is what I want to talk about because, of course... both Australia and New Zealand will host the next Women's World Cup, which obviously gives the Matildas a huge psychological boost. And it's only natural as we, you know, support the Matildas to talk about Sam Kerr in the past. But I think it's now time to admit, yep, okay, cool. She's probably our best player. Fantastic. But looking across the board, Lydia Williams in goal. I mean, Ellie Carpenter in particular, you know, is elite. Alana Kennedy, Chloe Lazargo. You know, we've got a really good team. Caitlin Ford, obviously Sammy Kerr herself, Hayley Rasso. And you're thinking, other than the fact that we know how good the States are playing at home, we'd have to be close to favourites, you'd think. You know, we'll see what the development's like over the next couple of years until then. But
no, I don't think there's any reason to say that the States are not the favourites at this stage. I mean, their record speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. And I know we certainly... would be considered as one of the teams that potentially could win it. Absolutely. But in terms of out-and-out favourites at this moment in time, I would still think that the States would be that. I mean, that's how high that bar is.
Yeah.
And you take into consideration the Matildas' last two games, you know, obviously weren't great. They weren't able to pick any Australian-based players because of the pandemic. Very limited time to prepare. That's really, really tough. So... Tony Gustavsson has a massive job on his hand to try and get things right, find the balance, get the girls together, work with them and develop into a system that he wants them to play, how he would like them to play and get them in the best possible shape for the World Cup. And obviously, he still has time to do that. He obviously has huge inside information and knowledge of the way that, you know, the US team plays, their strengths, their weaknesses, their ethos, work rate, all those sort of things, which... are all important to have those sort of inside information. But it's also between the time he left to the next World Cup, there is a bit of time. So things can change a little bit. But yes, listen, you kind of almost hope that all the girls are doing what they're doing now and more come the end of next season.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's fit. Everyone's flying. The girls have got together and had a couple of really good games under their belt with the national team and the Matildas. Gustavsson's, you're really starting to see a plan, an ethos, direction, and it's really there. And their fine-tuning leading up to that World Cup. And that's, for me, key.
Won't be long. Back to Ollie and Mark in just 15 seconds. If you enjoy Two Sharp Reds, though, make sure you search Gegenpod wherever you get your podcasts. David Wiener is joined by thousands of games of experience both on and off the field. It's a great listen. Gegenpod. The Gegenpod. Okay, back to Two Sharp Reds.
Halftime drinks here in the Two Sharp Reds, Mark. I've got to say, I'm looking outside. It's about 26 degrees today. And this Pinot, you know, if I had to be critical, is a delight. But I think I could swap it out for a rosé. I really, really could.
Well, if you're talking about the temperature, yeah. I've said to you before, you know, add a little bit of Fanta Limon to it.
Yep.
Yeah, and a bit of, you've done it before. And it's you rate it too, don't you?
It just feels unnatural, but I like it. So
yeah, but you know, go
far between for me, I think, with that.
Just go with it, mate. It's a way. Listen, I've gone for my McGuinn Estate,
yep.
Merlot, southeastern Australia. What can I say? To Merlot. Nice, easy drinking, smooth,
yeah,
drinkable with anything, really. Very, very easy, not too complex. I don't think you can actually. I don't think I've ever had a bad Merlot.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, this is the second week in a row you've got Merlot as well.
Yeah, yeah. I just lose track, mate. They all roll into one. But yeah, no, I'm more than happy with my Merlot. It's a good, steady drink.
Could you match it with a butternut squash from your garden?
Possibly could, you know. Funny you would mention my butternut squash, actually. I've planted some seeds for butternut squash as well. So,
what's the ETA on that? How long is it?
It'll probably be about 3 weeks, 4 weeks.
Oh, that's all right.
Some of my seeds have already come through. So I planted a whole lot of them last week. Yep. Some of them already started to come through already. Some cabbages started to poke through in my newly renovated greenhouse.
How is that?
Very excited. So yeah, no, listen, absolutely nice. You know, you can go a hearty meal, you can go a nice hot pot with a bit of butternut squash in it, which is always delicious. And that reminds me, because I've got the lamb out for some stewing lamb, got some bits and pieces with it, and I'm going to go down to my cellar and grab one of the butternut squash and chop it up and put it in there as well.
You know how to live, Mark, don't you?
I do.
You know how to live. Now, it feels like such a shame to talk about something so innocent and pure and beautiful, and then, you know, the juxtaposition here is not lost on me at all. I'm not sure if you've seen this, because it came out, I want to say maybe 35, 40 minutes before we started recording the podcast.
Okay, now I'm under pressure.
Yeah, now you're really under pressure. But there's a video that's emerged. And we are thinking at this stage that it's Sheffield United's Ollie McBurnie, and two or three fans are filming him and chatting to him, and he starts beating him up.
No way.
Properly attacking. They've said already that officials at Sheffield United are aware of the video circulating on social media and are currently investigating. I was having a really good think about it, though. And if they find him guilty, I think that's time. Like proper...
Well, it gives him a reason, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It gives him a valid excuse to release a player.
I meant like jail time, though. Like,
Gosh, yeah. The police certainly will be involved with that, you would think.
It's disappointing, though. Yeah, very frustrating to see.
Well, I mean, he has been in trouble before, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's an interesting character. He's well loved, but even down to things like when he was watching his former team play, and he's in the crowd and wearing, you know, their colours while you're still, you know, you're playing for another side, and it's just things that you go, come on, buddy, you just need to switch on a bit, I think.
Yeah, it's not clever, is it? It really isn't.
And yeah, you're right as well. You're starting to see a pattern with some of these, you know, guys, and you think, oh,
well, let's just hope it's a mistaken identity, and let's hope it's not actually him, and let's hope it's someone else.
Yep. Well, fingers crossed. On that front, that was too negative for mine, so let's move on. Just talk about something sad but beautiful. A bit of an on this day, Mark. On this day 5 years ago, we said goodbye to Upton Park, which was one of the, you know, certainly... For Aussies, you know, obviously coming to London, a lot of West Ham fans, a lot of QPR, a lot of Fulham fans, but to go to Upton Park, it seemed like a pretty special venue.
I think the English FA had a major say in pulling down the Bowling Ground. And that's to do with the fact that we beat England there 3-1. They were so disgusted with the result. They went, all right, let's get rid of all the evidence that's possibly out there and let's pull down the stadium. Let's give them London Stadium. Let's appease them that way. Listen, it was a great ground to go play at. I mean, the atmosphere was intense, full on. Pitch was always really, really nice. The fans were pretty hostile, pretty abusive, aggressive. Pretty much football fans, really.
Yes, exactly.
And it was always a difficult place to go and play. Absolutely. I have to say though, like I know why fans wouldn't like, you know, don't like the more modern stadiums so much, and certainly the non-purpose built football stadiums. Mm-hmm. And I get why there are fans who are disgruntled about moving to the London Stadium in terms of that closeness to a football pitch.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, still, I was there again yesterday, and every time I go there, I still look at it and go, it's a very cool stadium.
Yeah,
and I know it's a little bit far away. I know you are that slightly further away, but the facilities are so much nicer, so much better. The way they've decorated the stadium now, I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I really do. It feels like it is a West Ham ground. It doesn't feel like anyone else has any ownership on it whatsoever. It's them.
It's still pretty accessible though in terms of distance. You go straight to Stratford, mate, you're laughing. Like
Yeah, absolutely. And I think from crowd dispersing and all that sort of stuff from a ground, it's pretty quickly. And I know they have had issues, security issues and fighting and bits and pieces with away fans. I mean, you're gonna get that in most places, and there are idiots out there. Doesn't matter where you go, there are idiots in every walk of life, and there are idiots out there who just want to cause trouble. It doesn't matter. But I have to say I'm a fan of it. I did love the bowling ground. But I do really like London Stadium.
So let me ask you this then. That brings me on to a topic. I think it's probably safe to say that Tottenham's stadium is the most impressive in terms of what it can offer.
Oh, that hurt you, didn't it?
Well, it's true. Let's
it is. No, it's pretty
incredible, right?
In my opinion, it is the best stadium in this country. I think it's better than Wembley. It's better than all the stadiums. I don't think anything comes close to it.
So so some of the things that, you know, if you've not been able to attend, certainly, you know, most Aussies, you know, certainly, you know, haven't been able to travel, you know, to England since they sort of kicked into gear. It's got a you know, a lowering facility of the ground to turn it into an NFL stadium. You've got that new technique where you fill the beers up from the bottom up. That's pretty amazing. It's obviously, you know, bigger and better. It's got a giant cock. that looks over the stadium. What are some of the other? Because you've been there a few times.
Yeah. So the one end of the stands behind the goal, that entire stand has is one big bar, the full length of the back of the stand, and I think it's 25,000 people or 30,000 people in that stand or something like that. It is amazing. If you've not been, the minute you get an opportunity to go, you've got to go. It is an incredible stadium. It is, like I said. Everything about it is amazing. I mean, the way it sits up when you walk up to it, it just looks, oozes quality and class. The facilities are brilliant. I've walked around there when there's no one there. I've walked through it a little bit through people on a previous normal match day. And it just looks like one of those places. It's so cool that you go, love to go and have a beer there, actually. Yeah. Go stand at the bar and it just looks like a proper social place. You know, like you would want to go and hang out with your mates, even if there's not a football game, where you kind of go, how cool would this be if we just could come up here and hang out and talk football and watch some old games and drink and be a proper Spurs pub, you know, and even any football fans who just want to go and watch. I mean, obviously it's different over here, but certainly people from internationally come out and go, you know what, I want to go to a Spurs bar and have a beer, watch the old classic Spurs games or whatever it is, be pretty cool. Or the previous weekend's game as well. There's multiple TV screens. It's just, I can't speak highly enough about it.
So I'm going to ask you this then. Let's take out of the equation Chelsea, Arsenal, Man U, Liverpool and Man City. So the big stadiums, essentially. What's the number one, if you're travelling from Australia and you're just a general football fan, where's the one you'd recommend, whether it be from the look, the atmosphere?
Okay, there's two stadiums. Everything. For me, there's two stadiums, particularly if you're coming. Okay, so it really depends. If you can go anywhere in the country, then it's possibly slightly different. that if you go anywhere in the country, I would say there's three stadiums you should go to.
All right, hit me.
So Anfield.
Yeah.
Particularly as you're an Australian, most, you know, that's why Liverpool fans are huge in Australia, because the 80s, the success, that generation of people now and the indoctrination of kids and all sorts of stuff, right? Craig Johnson being an absolute superstar there. The tradition of Anfield, the cop, all that. You know, do a stadium tour, go to a game. Brilliant. And then the other two is both are in London. And one would say one is maybe biased, but it has to be Fulham.
Mm-hmm.
It is so unique. I mean, the Johnny Haynes stadium that runs along the roadside is unique. It's, I mean, heritage listed. Stunning. It's beautiful. It's stunning.
Yeah.
Quality. It's small, but it's compact, and you're there on the pitch. And then you've got the cottage in the corner, which, again, is so unique. You just don't see anything like it ever anywhere in the world. And funny enough, the cottage used to be positioned in the center circle. So it used to be like a hunting grounds, like a little park hunting ground area. And the cottage itself was positioned originally in the middle of where the center circle is today. And then once they turned it into a football pitch, they moved it. I think it burnt down and then they rebuilt it. The original burnt down and they moved and then they built it then where it is currently.
Hey, it's time we have you got your passport close by?
Not on me, but
okay, you know. We'll get it because it's time to go to Europe. It's time to head to the continent. There's a few things we need to tick off here. First one is friend of the show, of course, appeared on I want to say almost probably, you know what, a year to the day, around about this time during lockdown. He came on the show as of course a young socceroo in Aiden Hustik, who was, I believe, clubless at the time or had just left his club in the second division in Holland, I think. I think he might have been clubless.
No, I thought he was still there. I thought he was still there at that time.
Right, when we spoke okay. He has since moved to Eintracht Frankfurt.
Yep.
And he scored his first Bundesliga goal. Huge news.
Absolutely
for the young
massive.
Yeah,
he's had to wait some time to get game time. And that's huge, absolutely huge. And he's obviously taking his chance, you know, scoring his first Bundesliga goal, is a huge occasion. Eintracht Frankfurt fighting to try and finish in those European places as well. Listen, it's brilliant. The Bundesliga is a great league to play in, especially for young players.
Which is pretty good.
What's
Frankfurt
that?
Are in fifth. So,
yes.
You know.
It's all very, very tight. It's all a lot to play for. There's two rounds left of the Bundesliga. Obviously, we know that Bayern have kind of not romped away, but have won it. The good thing about Eintracht Frankfurt is they can't finish below fifth.
Okay.
Or could they? Yeah, technically they could. They could finish sixth if they lose their last two remaining games and Bayer Leverkusen win their last two remaining games. Because Bayer Leverkusen have actually a slightly better goal difference. Okay. It's still a lot to play with. However, Leverkusen, last game of the season, are away at Dortmund, which is always, you know, it's a bit of a derby as well. Leverkusen, Dortmund is in that part of the country. Whereas Eintracht Frankfurt, if you look at the last couple of seasons, they've been in and out of European competitions. They did really, really well a couple of seasons back in the Europa League, got to the semi-final, and he just got knocked out by Chelsea. They have a very doable remaining fixtures. They've got Schalke away. Schalke already relegated, having a disaster. And they've got Freiburg at home. Freiburg at home is certainly no easy game. But Freiburg will have nothing to play for. And it's all up to Eintracht Frankfurt to secure. They're a chance even still for Champions League.
So, Mark, let's go down from Germany and head towards Italy.
Before you go, we've got to talk about Robert Lewandowski.
Oh, come on then.
Mate, scored a hat-trick. They won 6-0 on the weekend. They've won the title. They cruised. They beat Borussia Mönchengladbach. Mm. So it's not like they've beaten a lesser team. They've beaten one of the better teams in the league. And they absolutely trounced them. I mean, Lewandowski should have scored a hat-trick inside 30 minutes. I mean, he took him to the 66th minute to score a hat-trick. Yeah. But literally, he should have. Going on the ability of Lewandowski and how many times, his ability to finish, the chances that he actually had and missed were like, wow, couldn't believe he missed them. Mm. So he should have at least scored five. Phenomenal. He is now on 30 9 goals
just
in a Bundesliga season. So he's one behind Gerd Müller, the all-time record. Gerd Müller set the record of 40 goals, and that stood for a long, 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 long time. He's on 39 goals, so he needs 2 more goals to break it. So Robert Lewandowski...
2 goals, 2 games.
39 goals in 32 games in the Bundesliga. 2 more goals, he breaks the record from Gerd Müller of beating 40 goals in one season, which is... Man, that is phenomenal. I mean, if he breaks it, anyone's going to break it, this is the guy that's going to break it. And it's hard to argue against him, even though I'd love Gerd Müller's record to stay because it is Gerd Müller. Mm-hmm. Robert Lewandowski has been insane.
Okay, Mark, let's now head down to Italy. Plenty going on that we can talk about. I will just say it's been a little while since the news is out there. So I think we don't really need to go too far into it, but at least acknowledge the fact that Jose Mourinho has done one of the smartest things I've ever seen and posted his CV across a week of Instagram. And he's got a job at AS Roma. But of course, the announcement happened again, like about 10 hours after we recorded the podcast. He must hate you.
Yeah.
All of these big, I don't know what it is. It feels like a vendetta against the Sharps.
He did send me a message afterwards saying, heads up, got an announcement to make.
Really?
Yeah. So well, sorry.
That's all right.
I didn't pass it on.
That's okay.
It just slipped my mind. I didn't realize.
Well, that's why you're best friend number two.
That was between, Jose sending me a message. John Terry was asking me a question about something.
Was he?
Peter Crouch wanted to know if I fancy coming and doing some robot dancing lessons. other than that, yeah, I was pretty busy. Sorry, mate.
What I would pay to see. to see that. but Juventus looking like they're going to play Europa League, and comments from their former boss in Maurizio Sarri saying, you can send me away, but this team is untrainable. Now, that is a big comment. Huge.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I'm not the biggest fan of Maurizio Sarri. Very, very, very blinkered in the way that he does things. And I suppose you could argue that a lot of managers are like that, I suppose. He wasn't very endearing in my experiences with him. Not that he was rude or anything like that. It's just I had some little interaction with him, but just wasn't just he didn't come across, certainly for me, as a genuinely likable person. You know, there's some people you just go, you can just tell that person's a decent person,
Yeah.
Whereas with Sarri, it just wasn't the way. Anyway, it's obviously struggled. And the Chelsea fans certainly didn't take to him either. They found it incredibly difficult, actually almost impossible. And I think he's burnt a few bridges since then. So certainly wasn't good. But yeah, Juve, gosh. It must be really difficult when you've got a player of the magnitude of Cristiano Ronaldo. You've got to try and fit it in, make it all work. He's very, very, very much focused on his own thing. Breaking records, doing everything, and almost like going, well, this is me and I'm doing all this. What are you guys? And that's the impression I kind of always read from him. And arguably, you can say rightly so, because he is so bloody good. I mean, you look at his goal scoring record this season alone in Serie A is, again, right up there. I mean, you can't even look at it and go, he's had a bad season, because actually he's been one of, still, in terms of return, he's still been one of the most, if not the most successful player at Juve this season. So it's hard to knock it. I think I'm just trying to look. He's played 30 games. He started 28 games, scored 27 goals in Serie A. I mean, for Ronaldo, that's actually not a great, that's not up there as being his best season. But as we all know, the bar is incredibly high. And he normally can jump that high to head it as well. a lot of problems there. I think it always is difficult. Arsenal still haven't recovered from the time of having a great side and the fall away has been constant. And Juve are in danger because they've got an aging squad, got some big decisions to make in the summer on the direction they take, And they, it's hard to think they would do like Arsenal are doing, but they've got to be careful that the next couple of seasons, they don't really drop away.
Mm.
They've got to bounce back as quickly as possible. So the next couple of weeks or months are vitally important for them to get those key decisions right, because you don't want to be the Arsenal of Italy, do you?
No, you don't. Mark, let's talk wine and wrap things up here on the Two Shot Reds. I've gone for a New Zealand Marlborough Pinot Noir. Brilliant, a nice, trustworthy, delightful red, perfectly ripe with a lot of exciting flavours. I've enjoyed it, but as I said, it's a little hot, so I wouldn't mind a rosé. But nevertheless, very happy. And as you said, quite rightly as well, you don't think that you can get a bad Merlot. So I trust that you enjoyed yours.
Yeah, I did. I have. I've certainly enjoyed my Merlot. I think it's been wonderful. It really has. Like I said, pleasant. It's a smooth, easy drinking wine with intense fruit flavors of plum and red berries. Oof. It is, what can I say? Just a good quality Merlot that I've really enjoyed. And go to if you're not quite sure what you want to drink. Merlot or a Pinot, can't go wrong. I've always said it. I've said it many, many times. I'm boring people senseless with it, but it's a no-brainer for me.
Okay, would you like to go first with the comparison?
I'll let you go first, mate.
Okay, this is a really straightforward one for me. I knew it straight away. Trustworthy. I like the fact that it says that. It's a trustworthy, delightful red. You know what you're going to get, and you're going to be happy with it. It's perfectly ripe. To the point where it suggests that you drink it from now to a year. So
right.
That's it, you know, and then it's probably going to go downhill. So we're talking this is perfect for at least another year. And it also suggests that you swish and move around the red in your mouth to try and pick up as many flavors as possible. So, of course, that's a tasting technique anyway, but the fact that it suggests that. So movement. I've got there lots of movement, and I watched this guy on the weekend. And when he plays, for someone who's aging, I got to say, I'm impressed by it. He's just busy. He's going left, right, and behind the lines, back in play. I love it. I love watching it. But I just think that the fact that you've got to drink this red essentially for the next 12 months and then it's done, it's reminded me of this guy. And that's Manchester United's Edinson Cavani. I think, you know, He's got that sort of 12 months left in him. He's got a lot of movement, but he's trustworthy. You kind of know that even if he doesn't blow the league apart, he's going to do a good job for you. So I'm going to compare nice. Marlborough to Cavani.
Nice. Well, I'm going to go with a player who I played with for one season at Middlesbrough. He's actually got one cap for England. So we signed him off the back of the season he had that very season in the Premier League with his former club, scored 15 goals by the February, got a call up for an England friendly match against the Netherlands mm-hmm. in 2002, played 45 minutes in that game and failed to score. And then from that game, he actually didn't go on and score another goal for Bolton the remainder of the season. So the irony on that one. Yeah. So from the February until the end of the season, after getting to 15 goals up to that point in the league, didn't score another goal. We signed him that following January at Middlesbrough for £3.5 million. We signed him from Bolton. He played 38 games and only scored 4 goals.
Oof.
Tell you what, on the training field, this guy had brilliant technique. Really, really good eye in front of goal. Like, he just went, wow. This kid's got something. This is special. And I can see why he scored 15 goals in the Prem, why he got a call up for England. But there's obviously something else with him as to why he's fallen away, why Bolton got rid of him when they did. So as smooth as this wine has been and as smooth as he was in that particular season where he scored 15 goals, it didn't last. And this wine is best enjoyed within 2 years of purchase, consumed within 2 days of opening. They certainly opened him too early. And he certainly didn't last those 2 years because he faltered massively after the time he came to us. And partly because I think he liked the McDonald's drive-thru far too much.
Sure. Respect. Got a lot of time for it. Go on. Yep.
Yeah, so with that in mind, the unveiling of who this person is, if anyone hasn't already guessed it, is a guy called Michael Ricketts.
Okay.
Striker, played at Bolton and then went on to Middlesbrough. And just, yeah, unbelievable, honestly. It was incredible to see his decline. He did go on to Leeds United after that, after leaving Middlesbrough, played 25 times for them. How many goals did he score?
One.
Zero.
Oh, no.
He went on loan to Stoke City and played 11 games. How many goals did he score?
Did he score none?
None.
Oh.
He did have a more successful period on loan at Cardiff City after that. After 17 games, he scored 5 goals.
Okay.
So he never reached double figures again after that.
Mark, thanks for a very enjoyable episode of the Two Sharp Reds. The
pleasure's all been yours.
One of your favourites. Thanks, Dad.
You're welcome, son.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.